what's going on. There's a war zone here today out in the heartland, but the union's here to stay. Those multinational bastards don't use tanks and guns, it's true, but they declared a war.
Now, Pacifica Radio Network special.
There's a war on the workers, and it's time we started calling the shots.
This is Building Bridges, your community and labor reports produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Jobs, jobs, jobs.
Later on, we present excerpts from the One Nation Working Together March on Washington, which brought hundreds of thousands of men and women from the working class belonging to hundreds of diverse organizations to the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C., to continue the call 47 years earlier of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. for jobs, 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 and justice.
But first, we feature the voice of a labor leader who is building bridges between workers internationally and sees the ties that bind the labor and environmental movements in the U.S., Leo Girard, president of the United Steelworkers with members in the USA and Canada, is a co-founder of the Apollo Alliance, whose goal is developing efficient energy alternatives to fossil fuels and jobs, jobs, jobs. Girard's multidimensional interest has made him a leader in advocacy for job creation, the creation of green jobs as the way to reindustrialize the U.S., and he is fighting to make sure that the U.S. trade relations change so that jobs are kept.
President Girard spoke recently at a forum sponsored by a group called Rekindling Reform and by the Murphy Institute for Worker Education and Labor Studies.
About trying to organize a activist militant labor movement. What we believe in the steelworkers is that the union has to be an instrument of social and economic justice. And for quite some time, I and my predecessors have been saying that the steelworkers union is not a slot machine union. You don't put your dues in and every couple of months pull the lever down and see what kind of coins fall out and think that that's the only thing you do. You can't make the lives of your members better unless you're making the lives of everybody in society better. So you have an obligation to not only fight for your members, but you have an obligation to fight for a better society, which takes us into all kinds of different battles than simply collective bargaining battles. We've been trying for a long time now to restructure our union so that it has the capacity to be activist. We've been trying to build that infrastructure in the union, so we have that network. To give you an example of how effective it can be, we were bringing forward a trade case, and we wanted to have some letters written. In less than 3 weeks, we generated 100,000 letters. And I would suspect that out of that 100,000, we probably had 70,000 that were individually done and 30,000 that were somebody running off form letters. But even if they're running off form letters, that's a piece of mail that's going to somebody who's got to take notice. Then we have our rapid response conference that we hold. All of these things we've done so that we can give people a place to get involved in the union. And not everybody wants to be a grievance officer. Not everybody wants to be on the safety committee. Not everybody wants to be in the political committee. So we created more space for people to find a role to get involved in. And then we've tried to decide, how do we take on the issues of the day? One of the ways we decided to take on what we saw was the upcoming issue. Campaigns for America's Future, the Sierra Club and the Steelworkers were the founding partners in creating the Apollo Alliance. The Apollo Alliance was designed and the name was picked to make a very strong statement, and it was that there were good jobs in what I would call climate change manufacturing. And that's what the Apollo Alliance was designed to do, is to develop policy, think about and promote how going to renewable energy could be a positive in revitalizing American industrial infrastructure. We thought, those of us that were in that original group, that we should be bold. And we should really make a strong statement. And so what we said is that as part of the Apollo Alliance, we're recommending that America spend $30 billion over 10 years in renewable energy. And we thought that was bold. In 2006, think real hard if you ever heard the word Apollo. in a presidential campaign or in a senatorial campaign. We couldn't get anybody to use it. It was too radical. So we concluded that we had good ideas, but we had no juice. We had nothing on the ground. We had nobody to generate this. So Carl Pope, myself, and Dave Foster got together and decided we'd create the Blue-Green Alliance. And it talks about the Sierra Club and the Steelworkers Union creating this alliance, and we would work on three things: climate change, trade, and toxics in the workplace. And Carl and I, in the 08 cycle then, went on the road, and we took community leaders from the Sierra Club and local union leaders from the steelworkers, and we did joint trainings, and we meshed it together in the Blue-Green Alliance. We went on the road, and we did 6 or 7 cities where we held forum, and we brought elected folks or people that were running for office. So we did Minnesota, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. And all of a sudden, we found that there was a real interest in this among environmentalists and blue-collar workers. 2 weeks ago, we admitted the Union of Concerned Scientists and the NRDC to the Blue-Green Alliance, and now the collective membership of the organizations that form the Blue-Green Alliance is 13.2 million. The Blue-Green Alliance has now got more people on the ground talking about climate change, talking about green jobs, than I think almost any other organization that's promoting this issue in the country. We've got dozens and dozens of our local leaders who now play a role in the Blue-Green Alliance, so we've changed that whole dynamic. We've now been able to run from place to place and kill the myth that was created by the same people and the same values that say, you can't have a good pension and high wages. You got to choose one or the other. You can't have a clean workplace and good jobs. I mean, I can remember growing up and driving by a paper mill with my dad to go see my uncle, and the smell and the stink, I'd lay on the back seat of the floor and pinch my nose in my dad's car, and my dad would say, knock that off, that's the smell of good jobs. And you were raised with this choice between polluted environment and good jobs, promoted by the same people who would tell you that you can't have good benefits and good wages. What we've been able to do with the Blue-Green Alliance is kill that myth. Good jobs or a clean environment. You're either going to have both or you'll have neither in the long run. The next piece of that is, how do you generate the next level of industrial job? And the reality is this. The aggressive right-wing promotion of unregulated trade, or trade that is regulated in the corporate financial interests, started the economic demise of America. The whole issue of so-called free markets is a myth. There can be no such thing as a free market. All markets need to have some form of regulation. If you want the purest form of free market, in my view, there's a terrific example this week. The purest form of a free market is when you give someone the choice to pay $75 for fire protection and they forget to buy it. That's the market. You want a service, you buy it. You want a pension, put your money in the stock market. You want a health care, get a voucher. The deregulation of trade, or the regulation of trade in the wrong interests, the deregulation or minimal regulation of financial markets, the deregulation of industry, there'd be some that would argue that the deregulation have kept costs down. I think there's other ways of keeping costs down. I do know this. When I get my electric bill, I got to sit down for 10 minutes to try to decipher what the hell it says and what I'm paying for. When I go to the airline, I feel real lucky when I get a seat where I can actually not fold my legs under me so that my knees don't hit the wall. If you look at what happened to the deregulated financial markets when people were many ways lied to, and I'll spend time on trade, everything that we were told, I'll start with NAFTA because before that's a little harder to document. Take everything you were told from NAFTA on. Turned out to be not true. Everything the labor movement said would happen turned out to be true. You remember being told that one of the reasons we needed to pass NAFTA so we could stop the flood of illegal immigration. One of the things we did, we destroyed Mexican farming, family farming, by flooding them with our subsidized products. But in exchange for that, we gave them jobs in factories along the border. Then after we had millions of them in factories along the border, and there's still lots there, and their currency went for a dump, whatever it is now, it's 16, 17 years after. Mexican workers' wages as a percentage of American workers' wages is worse off now than it was at the time of NAFTA, and our real wages have fallen. So we've made Mexican workers worse off. We put them in those factories in the Maquila. And once we had them there, we went off and did PNTR with China. And 5,000 factories left the Maquilas and went to China. Now, if you're a Mexican worker on this side of the border, you're starving. On that side of the border, you can have a chance to eat. What do you think you're going to do? The most important thing we could do to stop illegal immigration to America is make sure that we help the Mexican raise their standard of living. People don't leave their family and their home behind because they want to come here and cut somebody's goddamn grass. They leave because they're desperate. Then if you look what's happened in America during that period of time, year after year after year, we've had a record-breaking trade deficit. There's only 2 years in the last 25 where we didn't break the record. This may be the third. 08 and 09, we didn't break records. Because in 08, we went in the tank, and 09, we stayed in the tank, and we'll see what happens in 2010 by the end of the year. I don't know. I do know that the last couple of months, we set records with China. So, again, everything we were told about PNTR with China has turned out to be not true. We were told that the low-end jobs would leave, and we'd all become high-end work. Probably a lot of you go for your x-rays at the hospital, or your cardiograms and all that, and they'll give you the reading on that in a couple of days. That stuff sent over to China or India or Bangladesh or somewhere. And some radiologist that's making next to nothing reads your thing and sends it back. And that job that you went to school for to be a radiologist or an x-ray reader, whatever they call that thing, doesn't exist. We had a $79 billion, with a B, $79 billion deficit in what's called advanced technology products with China and India. The modern wind turbine, anybody know where it came from? Who would have ever thought that the modern wind turbine would be invented in Sandusky, Ohio? Would you assume there'd be a turbine factory in Sandusky, Ohio? I don't know if they make helicopters. I know they don't make wind turbines. In the last 3 years, China has announced it's going to dominate the world market in solar panel production, in solar energy. China now produces 40% of the world's solar panels. That's pretty close to domination. China has doubled its exports of wind turbines to America. In the economic renewal program, think back to our $30 billion. In the economic renewal program, I think there was something like $80 or $85 billion, I forget the number, for renewable energy programs. But the renewable energy programs, that opening in the last 2 years, you got to have that wind farm up or that solar farm up or that geothermal unit up, you got to have that up within 2 years. In a section of the budget that was passed for that is a section called 48C, which is the amount of money that will be set aside so that you could start a facility that would build those panels or turbines or geothermal units. And there's $5 billion in that. Now, I'm not very smart, and I'm certainly not the smartest pencil in the box or the brightest light on the elevator. But if I give you $85 billion to set up a wind farm, and you got to do it in 2 years, and I give you $5 billion to help factories do it, and it takes 2.5 years to get your factory licensed and up and get the other capital and get all that, where will this come from? Almost anywhere but us. Hence comes the inability to raise capital from banks that are already being chiselers, already can make more money by just sitting on their money, because we're giving them money at next to no cost. So you can't raise money from banks. You can't get access to the government support in quick enough time to put your factory up to service the new wind farm that's going to go up. And all of a sudden, you read in the paper that the Chinese are going to build a wind farm in West Texas, and they're going to get our tax dollars to do it. And the Steelworker Union said, the hell with that. And we went to allies in the House and in the Senate and started to raise hell. And Chuck Schumer and Sherrod Brown and a few others started making noise that they would bring forward legislation that would preclude the use of American taxpayer dollars for imported renewable energy products. All of a sudden, the steelworkers start getting calls from the Chinese. And we've entered into agreement with what I think is a shell company called A-Power. I don't even think they exist. I think they might have made one turbine. But their arm is Shenyang Power. Shenyang is the power arm of the city of Shenyang in China. So we've entered into an understanding with them that if they're going to stand up any wind farms in America, they're going to do it by using American-made products, and that they give the union neutrality and card check if it's in a new facility. That only comes about through all of that network I've been weaving through. Because when the Texas wind farm hit the news, Rapid Response hit the button and started writing letters. And people started, what the hell, we're going to get this spread all over us. Then we figured out, how could they ship those turbines here? Turbines are big. How can they do that cost efficiently? They can do it because China has a different economic system than we do. They get all kinds. I mean, we couldn't believe, I couldn't catalog the kind of incentives and support that they get to dominate or to double their exports. I'll tell you a steel story. We got a trade lawyer, Terry Stewart from Washington. We started doing a lot of research. And we filed a 5,800-page filing with the U.S. Trade Commission under a section of the Trade Act called Section 301, alleging 5 specific violations of WTO rules by China. We only filed it for what we would euphemistically call green jobs or renewable energy jobs. And the reason we did that is strategic in 2 ways. One, if we don't find a way to catch hold of industrial manufacturing for renewable energy really quickly in the next year or two, America will be so far behind it can never catch up. And there'll be no difference in relying on Chinese wind turbines versus imported oil. There'll be no difference in relying on an imported solar panel, imported wind turbine, imported geothermal, than imported oil. You'll have to rely on someone else. The other thing is that forget about whether you're pro or con the nuclear industry. Everybody goes every which way. You need a diversified energy strategy. But not long after the announcement of the Texas wind farm is an announcement by our government that they're going to fund $7 to $8.5 billion of support for the first 2 nuclear reactors on the drawing board down south. And you scratch your head. You figure, how are they going to do that? Westinghouse announces that it's already got the specs for that, and they want to get this up within a couple of years. You go and you research the specs, and you find that the specs have been written to exclude the American steel industry in building the containment vessels because we didn't make the steel the way that they had in the spec. And all of a sudden, you find that the specs are written to meet Asian steel suppliers. Then you scratch your head and you say, well, why would Westinghouse do that? Because Westinghouse is no longer owned by an American. Westinghouse is owned by the Japanese. They wrote the specs to serve their industry. I have nothing against that. The question is, why the hell aren't we doing that? So the steelworkers again wrote off a letter to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, NRC, and we demanded an investigation of every part. PLA should include manufacturing. So those are the fights we're having. And I spend a lot of time on that because I'm absolutely convinced that if we don't find a way to revitalize American manufacturing, there is no way out of the economic mess we're in. How do you generate wealth in a country? You can't generate wealth by selling collateral debt offerings. We've proven that, haven't we? You can't generate wealth by creating illusions that this paper is worth something when it's not. You can't generate wealth by tranching bad mortgages and selling them as AAA bonds. We've proven that. You hear them talking about the deficit. Does anyone in this room know what the accumulated trade debt America has poured over itself since passage of NAFTA? The last numbers I saw was we've accumulated a trade debt over the, whatever it is, 17 years now, of roughly $7.2 trillion. Now, that isn't necessarily a debt you hold on your books. Those are wealth transfers. That's somebody buying your shit, literally. And you can't. You're paying it off. So you set that over here, and this year we're heading towards $500 billion. And if we get back on the trajectory we were on before the economic collapse, the trajectory that we were on before 08 would have led us to almost $1 trillion by 2012. And I've said to all kinds of economists, and no one has given me an answer yet, I've asked 2 things. What do you think will happen to America when we hit an annual trade debt of $1 trillion a year, if that trajectory keeps going? Question number 2. If having a huge, huge trade deficit is so good for the economy, why aren't other nations clamoring for one? Right? You hear the Rubenistas and that crowd, the Clintonians, you hear all of them talking about how, you know, opening world markets, opening trade is good, and ta-da, ta-da, and the fact that we can hold this trade debt is a signal of the strength of the American economy and all of that. We've been devaluing our currency as quick as we can try to get it devalued, and the Chinese have been buying it up as quick as they can to keep us from devaluing as much as they would like us, and blah, blah, blah. All that smoke and mirrors. This is a huge issue that is not getting any attention. So you set that over here, and we're going to have to fight about that. And if you read just most recently, that I think again in the New York Times, someone wrote, maybe the Wall Street Journal, free trade is now falling out of favor. I was on a phone call the other day, don't need to say who was all on it, but there was a whole bunch of sort of stammering and saying that they need a new story to tell. They need to recalibrate the message. You can recalibrate the message all you want when trade is costing you jobs. That's the issue. So you put that over there. You put this stupid political environment we're in, where last week, such a common sense proposal, we would reward companies that bring jobs back from overseas to America, and we would take away the subsidy that we give companies to move jobs out of the country. Somebody's got to tell me what's wrong with that. Every Republican voted no, plus four Democrat senators. I can't figure that out. I cannot figure that out. So you set that there. You set our 301 petition there. You set that we've brought trade cases against China, steelworkers have, on coated free sheet paper, on pipe and tube, on other steel products, and we've won every case. Do you know why? All you need is the facts, because that's the way China does business. And if you don't hold them accountable, they won't change. And I'm not anti-Chinese. I'm not anti-trade. I really believe that nations have to trade. I just believe that you ought to have it on fair footing. Then you take the other mountain of stupidity. We worked our ass off because we wanted some fairness. We wanted changes in the healthcare system. We wanted a healthcare system that everyone could have healthcare and could save the country money. You know which system would have saved the country the most money? Single payer would have saved over $400 billion a year. We have this huge debate about letting the tax break for ultra-rich continue. And the average person doesn't have a clue what it's about, right? And you scratch your head and you say, why are we having this debate? Well, the reason you're having this debate is during the Bush gang, they passed the tax breaks that expire now because by having them expire less than 10 years, they didn't have to account for them. So all these Republicans that fought for these tax breaks for the ultra-rich and a little bit for us, a little bit, your $36 tax break doesn't do very much compared to the millionaire's $36,000 tax break, but you got a little bit. Off the books, allegedly, cost somewhere between $750 and $900 billion. These same bastards, and I believe they are now fighting, blaming Obama for the deficit. And we fought two wars off the books. And so last month, we have this huge protracted debate about extending unemployment benefits for people who lost their jobs as a result of Wall Street corruption, where not sufficiently went to jail yet. One poor guy went to jail. He got caught. It's easier to nail one guy, right? He'll probably get an ankle bracelet and hang around home. You know? So we have this big fight about that. And Republicans get up and say, well, if you're going to do that, you're going to have to show us how you can pay for it by cutting something else. You don't hear a word about that and extending the tax cut for the ultra-rich. And what are we doing? We as the collective we. We're getting amnesia. And we're letting the guys, and they're mostly guys, who created the mess, blame us because we inherited their mess. So our union has built this infrastructure inside the union. And today, that infrastructure is working as hard as I can make it work. Because there is no path to success if we go back to what was being done the way it was being done. And we have to talk about jobs. I fundamentally believe that the next industrial revolution will come from putting society to work, and America and Canada, where I'm from, should lead on remanufacturing itself to fight climate change. Our union said in 1990 that climate change was going to be the greatest social problem that society would face in the years coming. And you know what? I'm pretty naive, I think. I still want to think that I'm an optimist, although some days I have to kick myself. There's millions of jobs in taking carbon out of the air, taking greenhouse gases out of the air. What we need is the political will. We need the direction. We need the desire. We need the consensus. We need the commitment. Imagine how many jobs you'd create if our federal and state governments got together and said that they're going to start a retrofitting campaign, retrofitting to current science, current knowledge, current industrial capacity of every municipal, state, and federal building built prior to 1960, bringing up to the highest energy efficiency standards. And that would be a 10-year project. Then the next 10-year project would be taking the buildings between 1960 and 1980 and bringing up to current scientific standards. Think about the millions of jobs. Then if we said to employers, and I'm not thinking always of the U.S. Steels and the General Motors and all that, but the average employers, the small shops and the foundries and the factories and the folks who do little jobs, the mom and pops, as we call them in our union. Imagine if you give them the kind of financial incentive, give them the technical support, train people in universities to go out and give small businesses the kind of engineering support they can't get because they can't afford to hire an engineer, and have them help in industrial retrofitting so that they're using less energy, that they're more efficient, and they can pay their workers better as a result. And then think about what happens if America says, we're going to understand that mass transit creates jobs. Puts high-speed rail back on. Could we do high-speed rail? Guess what? There's only two rail manufacturers left in America. Ike Gitlin comes from one in Steelton, PA, and the other one's up in Pueblo, Colorado. So if somebody said that over the next 2 years we're going to put in 5,000 miles of high-speed rail, we'd have to get the rail from China. If someone says over the next 20 years we're going to do 25,000 miles across the country of high-speed rail, someone would build new rail mills and people would go back to work. If America says we're going to support the Steelworkers 301 petition and we're not going to let the Chinese dump their wind turbines and their solar panels in America, we're going to develop a solar panel and a wind turbine industry ourselves. Because we invented it, we'd have tens of thousands of people working in those industries and we'd be more efficient. So for me, I never ever dreamt. I pinched myself lots of times figuring, how the hell did I ever get this job? I get paid to tell people to go to hell. I get paid to give people shit, and I get paid to think. I mean, it's got to be one of the best jobs in the world, But I really believe this. If we don't turn the labor movement from what it is now into a comprehensive activist organization from the top of the AFL-CIO to the newest local union, so that we're activists for social change as well as economic well-being for our members, present, past, and future. And if we don't take on the challenge of rebuilding industrial America, my kids and grandkids will have a lesser opportunity in life than I did. And I'm at the point in my life, I've been there for a while now, where it ain't about me. In this economic meltdown, I got six adults in my family, my wife and I, my two daughters and their two husbands. For a year, there was only one of us had a job. I can survive that. I have a good living. I can help my kids. But when I'm not here, what are my grandkids going to do? That's the challenge. We're at a turning point. We got to build an activist labor movement. We got to mobilize. We got to do One Nation every Saturday in different parts of the world, different parts of the country. And we've got to fight for a rebirth of industrial America. And then we'll be able to sit in our rocking chairs and say that we help create a better world and a cleaner climate.
And you were listening to Leo Girard, president of the 850,000-member United Steelworkers of America, on the need for an activist labor movement to rebuild the country by advocating for jobs, and especially green jobs. This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. And now selections from speeches and interviews from the massive demonstration at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C., that President Girard promoted to take across the country and world to build an activist movement, the One Nation Working Together March on Washington, sponsored by the AFL-CIO, NAACP, La Raza, and hundreds of progressive organizations to demand the jobs to put people to work and back to work.
Nation. My name is Angela Orofsky from Bent Salem, Pennsylvania. I know how painful it is to be out of work. I was laid off 2 years ago. I've been looking and looking with no avail. This year I joined Working America as a volunteer because I know I may be unemployed, but I've still got a job to do. I am organizing jobless people because it's horrible out there. All we want is work. I don't believe that's too much to ask. Working people need to catch a break sometime. Thank you.
I'm Bernie Hall, and I'm from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and I'm proud to say that I'm a steelworker. I'm marching today because we need to bring manufacturing jobs back to America. We need to rebuild our crumbling infrastructure, our roads, our bridges, and our schools. We need to get back to making things in America again.
Thank you, union brothers and sisters.
We are your neighbors. Are you standing with us, sisters and brothers? We are one nation. One nation coming together. We are one nation coming together. Again, we are one nation coming together. Thank you, brothers and sisters.
You are a great American patriot, Mr. Van Jones.
Good to be here. It's our turn now. It's our turn to put our vision forward. And it's important that we do that because as beautiful as today is and as beautiful as we are here together in this bright sunshine, we're going to be going home soon to some dark conditions. And there are people who would love to be here right now, but they can't because they are home dealing with tough situations. Right now, there's somebody in Indiana or Michigan, Ohio, somebody who's an industrial worker, somebody who knows how to build cars, somebody who has the best training in the world, but they're sitting idle, and they don't know when they're going to work again. Right now, there's a mother somewhere watching her child go out into an urban neighborhood where they don't have enough programs and enough opportunity. She doesn't know if she's going to ever see her son again. He may be in jail tonight or on his way to a grave. She's looking at this demonstration hoping there'll be some answers for her. Right now, there are people in red states, rural farmers, had a little family farm for 2-3 generations, about to lose it because they can't have enough income. They don't need hateful rhetoric. They need real solutions. And we've got real solutions. So if you want to see the future, look up. Look at the sun. Look at the Saudi Arabia of solar power we have beaming down on us that can help to power America. If you want to see the future, look up. Look at the wind. Look at the sky. Imagine the wind power that we could have powering America in a new way. Let's put America back to work. Our scientists tell us that if we do not begin to move off of oil and coal and these greenhouse gases, we're going to bake the planet. So the most important work that we have is to repower America in a clean way. Let's connect the people who most need work with the work that most needs to be done. Fight pollution and poverty at the same time. Beat global warming and the global recession at the same time by putting America back to work. That's what we can do together. Let those industrial workers build wind turbines. Each wind turbine, 8,000 finely machined parts, more than a car. Each wind turbine, as much steel as in 26 cars. We could put America back to work, our steel workers back to work, our auto workers back to work, building wind turbines to power America. And if we had wind farms off our coast, if we had wind farms off our coast, when they collapse, you never have a wind slick that comes and messes up the environment. I've never heard of a wind slick or a sun spill. There's a smarter way to do this now, and we can do that. Let those children in urban America be trained to retrofit houses, to put in new windows and boilers and furnaces and insulation and solar panels on top so houses waste less energy. So we can save grandmama on her energy bill, but also create jobs for those kids in the community. There's a smarter way to do this, real solutions. Let those farmers who are out there have a new business to be in. They don't just have to be in the food production business. They can be in the energy production business. Let them put those wind turbines on their property. Let them grow an energy crop. Let them capture carbon in the soil and participate in the carbon markets. We're not just talking about an agenda for blue states and urban America. We care about folks in red states, too, and we have real answers for them. Real answers, not just hateful rhetoric. Real answers. So in conclusion, let me just say this to you. We have an environment in crisis, and an economy in crisis. The earth is overheating, the temperature is going up, and job prospects going down. We can fix them both at the same time. We have the opportunity to put the one solution in place that will fix them both at the same time. And if we do that, we will finally have an environmental movement in America that is certainly correct in saying we shouldn't have any throwaway aluminum cans. We don't have any throwaway aluminum cans. We don't have any throwaway newspapers. That's right. We should be recycling those dead materials. But we also don't have any throwaway children or neighborhoods or workers either. And let's have an environmental movement that can take care of that too. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
I'm standing in the midst of a sea of red shirts, which are CWA Local 1180 shirts. And we're with Arthur Chiliotis, an author. How many of your members came, and why are you here, brother?
We have four buses, a couple of hundred people. We would have ordered more buses if we could have found more buses, but we couldn't. There was a great enthusiasm and an understanding on the part of the members of how important this forthcoming election is to begin to change this country around, and understanding that the rhetoric that we hear in the mass media does not reflect the reality of life for most working Americans, or an understanding of the power relationships and dynamics that need to change if we're to be effective at bringing about change for working people.
And what specifically are the issues that you're most concerned about?
We've got to try to address the issue of how the rich got so rich over these last 30 years. And I think the core of that is going back to the Reagan tax cuts that allowed people who were all very rich to get even more money, which they invested very wisely in the Congress and the state legislatures. And they effectively stripped our democracy of the regulatory authority that government agencies have to run their operations. You see it in terms of the SEC and the economic crash. You see it in terms of the oil and mining industries and what happened in the Gulf. It's all a matter of corporate America getting their people in, sabotaging from within government agencies that should be run by career civil servants rather than people who take the revolving door to get in and out and really work for the corporations or just work for the government part-time to make sure that they're not regulated. It's a matter of taking back our government and putting into place people who are committed to the American people and not to this greedy, self-serving profit agenda that has brought about the destruction of our economy.
You're the president of Communication Workers of America, Local 1180. More and more I see a kind of obfuscation of the concept of class. People address the middle class, and it's as though everybody is in the middle class. But the concept of working people and working class seems to have disappeared from the lexicon of virtually every politician and certainly in the media discourses. Do you have any thoughts about what it means to be a member of the working class and why it's important to define people as workers?
The definition I like to use is working class. Because if you need a paycheck in order to have a roof over your head, clothing on your back, and food in your stomach, you're part of the working class. If you don't go to work, you're not going to be able to survive. That's what I look at as a definition of the working class. But of course, we live in a society where we have had, over the last 30, 40 years, brainwashing. The American people did not realize what happened to them, how they've been sold this bill of goods, that somehow they are better off. And so we need to understand that one of the elements that makes the working class the middle class are unions. And the investing class in this country over the last 30, 40 years did, in fact, attack industrial America, to bring down industrial America, because that's where unions were. And the result is we don't have an industrial base in our country anymore. We don't make anything here anymore because, like Ahab searching for the great white whale, the investing class was ready to slay the whale, even if it meant the destruction of the whole damn ship and every crew member aboard, because they're focused on killing the American labor movement for what it does for the American worker.
Arthur, for the last 10, 20 years, the union movement has stumbled, has fallen, and has gotten smaller, except for the public sector. But now the public sector, the government unions are under attack.
Of course.
What's your thoughts on that?
Over 30 years ago, I attended my first New York State AFL-CIO convention. At that convention, the president of the shoe workers got up and talked about the fact that they're importing shoes from Italy. His union was losing membership over that. Now, I was in the public sector union, so I didn't give it much thought. Years later, it was the textile workers. Years later, the garment workers and the auto workers. They've gotten through that part of the list. The next people on the list that are unionized are public workers. So now they're coming after us because they've already wiped out the other ones. It's to be expected, given what the agenda of the investing class is. We are the last bastion that offers working people a chance to live with some dignity, that gives them a decent wage, benefits, and a pension that they can retire on and live with dignity. Those things seem to be a threat to them, and they will do what they can to get away with them. The unfortunate part is they are turning one half of the working class against the other to achieve it. They are convincing people to vote for candidates who are prepared to institute a destruction of labor in the public sector as well, rather than people in the private sector doing what they need to do, and that is organize and unionize to get the protections that they need and look at the government workers' standard of living as a standard they need to achieve.
CWA Local 1180, who are your workers?
We represent mid-level and supervisory employees in New York City government primarily. We also organize in the private sector in the nonprofit areas, such as Planned Parenthood, The Nation magazine, and some other units as well. So for us, it's important that we in the public sector, who unfortunately, for most working people, are invisible. People turn on their tap and they expect clean water, and they get it. That's delivered by the public sector. People flush the toilet and expect it to just go away, and it does. But they don't think about the fact that it's public sector workers that make sure it's properly disposed of. Picking up the garbage, keeping the streets maintained, educating children, providing for the public health. All things that are invisible. And people ask often, well, what are my taxes going for? You don't even realize what your taxes are going for. Because the public sector does it so well, you don't even notice it. It is only when it doesn't work that the corporate media focuses on that and magnifies it far beyond the proportion that it should be. It is easy to just point to the mistakes and not acknowledge and understand what goes on day to day without you even realizing it. Government workers are the foundation upon which commerce, industry, and the civil society are built. And there are those in the private sector who would rather not have a civil society. They would rather have distress and anarchy, because from that they are able to profit. And that is exactly what they do.
Arthur Chiliotis, thanks. You're heartened by the splendid turnout in your red shirts today. And this splendid outpouring of, well, I think hundreds of thousands of people. I haven't heard any official numbers, but that's what it looks like to me. We're here with Mary Kay Henry, president of SEIU, that's Service Employees International Union. Mary?
Welcome to Washington, D.C.
And it's always good to be welcome. There's enough SEIU purple and white and yellow shirts. It is an absolute spectacular array of SEIU, among other labor unions that are present here today.
IBEW, UAW, the AFL-CIO, we're really proud to stand with all of our union brothers and sisters here.
And what does it mean to see this enormous outpouring of organized labor? What's the message behind that?
That we want 25 million jobs created in this country. We need to get back to work. We don't want to give up on the dream of owning a home or putting our kids to college or expecting that we can retire with dignity. We think everybody should be able to expect that for ourselves. And we think corporate America is sitting on a greater profit and higher CEO bonuses than in any time in our economic history. And that we need to get corporate America to share responsibility for getting us back to work.
One of the ways to improve conditions of workers is, of course, through legislation. But another way is organizing workers into unions. And one way to help that would be the Employee Free Choice Act. What kind of priority would you like for Congress and the President to place on that piece of legislation?
We think it's a top priority to make sure that workers can form unions, and we think we share responsibility as a labor movement for getting back into the streets and reaching out to private sector workers. And even without a change in the law, we want to bring as many private sector workers into our union, into the entire labor movement as possible, because it is the only way workers can lift their wages is through unions.
Mary, there are certainly sectors of the working class and the middle class that have delivered an extremely contemptuous message and ire and anger against working people, against organized working people as well. How do you understand that, and how do we begin to re-enculturate people with a message as to who really built this country and the value of work and the respect that must be had for workers and who, if you will, the real enemies are?
The way I understand the ire is that people are scared, that this is a time of incredible economic uncertainty, and that's why days like today are so important for us to join hands between the labor movement, the environmental movement, the women's movement, the LGBT movement. All these different groups coming together, I think, can show that we can affect change and then reach out to the people that are scared and say we can rebuild our country and get back to work.
There's a lot of anger out there, not only towards the Republicans, but also towards the Democrats. What do we need to do differently, both in the union movement and also in the other movements for social change, and also what does Obama need to do differently going forward?
I think we need to have a common economic analysis about where the problem is in this country. And our belief is that corporate America have been let off the hook here, and we need to get our government and working people to join hands and hold corporate America accountable for getting America working again.
So the most important question, this is a fabulous base. It's a beautiful base. Where do we go from here? How do we keep up the momentum? How do we begin to build the movements that take us to the glorious pace we want to be, aside from getting many more jobs?
We think we need to turn out in record numbers November 2nd.
One of them, it seems as if we mobilize around the elections and then demobilize after the election.
We're not doing that again. We're going to stay mobilized during after this election and make sure we deliver the change that we voted for.
We're going to hold you to that, and you're going to keep us together.
We'll see each other in the streets.
Lots of more purple, yellow, and white shirts. Thank you for all your work.
Thank you.
It's about the power to the people. I want to turn the program over now to my great progressive brother, Mr. Joe Madison.
I just found out they sent in a satellite image of the crowd. Somebody go tell Glenn Beck there are more people here right now than there was on the 29th. In the back, can I say it? Hello! Go run and tell that to the Tea Party folks. 47 years ago, A. Philip Randolph said, if you look for the enemies of Medicare, of higher minimum wage, of Social Security, of federal aid to education, there you will find the enemy of the Negro, the coalition of Dixiecrats and reactionary Republicans that seek to dominate Congress. Advance those words to 2010, change Dixiecrat to Tea Party, reactionary Republicans, they're still there, and we cannot let them dominate Congress or the White House. We stand on the shoulders of some people who are here on the front row, and the front row is where they should be. Let me recognize one of the Little Rock Nine. Ladies and gentlemen, please Ernie Green, give him a round of applause. It is now my honor to introduce another giant who's been on the scene for seems like ever. You only have to say two words. Harry Belafonte.
Thank you. I would like to start off by thanking all my brothers and sisters in 1199 and the president of that union, Mr. George Gershom. Thank you for inviting me to participate in today's ceremony. In 1963, Martin Luther King Jr. stood on the steps of this memorial and declared that this nation should come together and embrace its greater ideals. He said that we should rally together and overcome injustice and racism, and that all citizens should not only have the right to vote, but that we should exercise that right and make America whole. That is part of why we are here today. But we are also here to tend to other grievances. Martin Luther King Jr. said that America would soon come to realize that the war that we were in at that time, in Vietnam, was not only unconscionable, but unwinnable. 58,000 Americans died in that cruel adventure, and over 2 million Vietnamese and Cambodians perished. Now today, almost a half a century later, as we gather at this place where Dr. King prayed for the soul of this great nation, tens of thousands of citizens from all walks of life have come here today to rekindle his dream and once again hope. All America will soon come to the realization that the wars that we wage today in faraway lands are immoral, unconscionable, and unwinnable. The Central Intelligence Agency tells us that the enemy we pursue in Afghanistan and in Pakistan, the Al-Qaeda, they number less than 50, I say 50 people. Do we really think that sending 100,000 young American men and women to kill innocent civilians, women and children, and antagonizing the tens of millions of people in the whole region somehow makes us secure? Does this make any sense? The president's decision to escalate the war in that region alone costs the nation $33 billion. That sum of money could not only create 600,000 jobs here in America, but would even leave us a few billion to start rebuilding our schools, our roads, our hospitals, and affordable housing. It could also help to rebuild the lives of the thousands of our returning wounded veterans. Dr. King loved this nation. He saw that this great nation should not be allowed to perish. Martin's vision was also the vision of Abraham Lincoln, who understood the evil of slavery, and in abolishing that evil, saved America. Although slavery may have been abolished, crippling poison of racism still persists, and the struggle still continues. We have the largest prison population in the world. And as we industrialize these prison systems, we rob hundreds of thousands of workers of the jobs that they need and the wages that are rightfully theirs. The plight of women bear no better. Their oppression refuses to yield as rape and domestic violence and sex slaves and teenage pregnancy abounds. But perhaps the greatest threat of all is the undermining of our Constitution and the systematic attack against the inalienable rights of the citizens of this nation, rights that are guaranteed by our Constitution. At the vanguard of this insidious attack is the Tea Party. This band of misguided citizens is moving perilously close to achieving villainous ends. This gathering here today is America's wake-up call. The giant called democracy is at last stirring again. Citizens are coming together to say freedom does not sleep. It may have been fueled and lulled for the moment into a lethargy, but it's fully awake now, and we the people are its engine. We must awaken the apathetic, the cynical, the many angry doubters who see their future as the perpetual hopelessness, and show them that our greatest weapon is the vote, and it is the answer to much that nags at us. On November 2nd, in the millions, we must overburden our voting booths by voting against those who would see the nation become a totalitarian state. Americans know that Dr. King's dream is not dead. Let us vote on November 2nd for jobs, for jobs, for jobs, for peace, for justice, for human rights, for our children, and the future of America. And let us put an end to war. Peace is necessary for justice. It is necessary for hope. It is necessary for our future. I love you all.
You've been listening to speeches and interviews from the One Nation Working Together March on Washington. Before that, Steelworkers President Leo Girard on building a movement to create the reindustrialization of the country by creating green jobs. The music has been Steelworker Eddie Starr's rendition of Ann Feeney's song, War on the Workers. This has been a Building Bridges Your Community and Labor Report special on the economic crisis. Produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. We invite you to visit our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org. That's buildingbridgesradio.org.
There's a war on the workers. We just do it.